I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the darkness. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight inside me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in the fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, fighting in for that key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run it down my country, man, you walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here, Light Resistance Radio. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia. And all of you may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Wow, here's an excellent piece by a doctor friend of mine, Mr. R.E. Sutherland, and he makes, he's actually passing on a news article from Cyril Hedge. Look what's coming to the United States, largely because of illegals. Los Angeles goes medieval, suffers outbreak of flea-borne typhus. It's a flea-borne disease, and Dr. Sutherland comments, reminder, our hotels and retail stores now have bed bugs because our illegal alien migrants carry them in their clothing and hair. They are very tiny and drop off on the floor in clothing in dressing rooms, live in the carpets. This is a big problem, and it's not gone away. Even the five-star hotels are combating bed bugs. Now, here comes the typhus carrying fleas on rats. And he quotes the Book of the Apocalypse, as Catholics call it, or the Revelations. I looked, and behold, an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. Authority was given to him over a fourth of the earth, to kill with sword, and with famine, and with pestilence, and by the wild beasts of the earth. So the, I think a sort of a biblical nightmare of widespread disease, or pestilence, as it used to be called. And actually, before I get to the issue of the flea-borne typhus, when I ran for mayor in the in the Ontario city of Hamilton this past October, one of the issues that was brought to my attention was the issue of bed bugs. Now, I've heard from a colleague in Toronto about an incident with bed bugs, and they're extremely difficult to eradicate. And of course, they don't know property divisions in apartments or condos or even houses. They feel quite free to migrate from place to place as the spirit or the opportunity moves them. So my friend actually spent several years and a number of fumigations of her building before the bed bugs were dealt with, at least temporarily. And when I ran for mayor, this turned out to be an issue in Hamilton, and although people won't say it, it would appear that the resurgence of bed bugs has a lot to do with the people that are flooding into our country. And this is the article from Zero Hedge News by Tyler Durden. Residents and officials in the city of Los Angeles, California, are horrified that their city has descended into a third world hellscape of poverty and disease. The typhus outbreak raging through the city is a flea-borne disease often reserved for socialist and poverty-stricken dystopias like Venezuela. But that's modern Los Angeles. Typhus is spread by fleas hitching a ride on rats. While the general population struggles with the weight of the government, local, state, and federal in LA's case, and the homeless population continues to climb up, the same cannot be said for the rats that carry fleas that cause typhus. The rat population in Los Angeles is doing just fine. However, as piles of garbage dot the cityscape, making it Thanksgiving Day every day for the city's fat, happy rodents. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website, and they of course are centered in Atlanta, murine typhus is also called endemic typhus or flea-borne typhus. It's a disease caused by a bacteria called Rickettsia typhi, and it is spread to people through contact with infected fleas. People will get sick with murine typhus when infected flea feces are rubbed into cuts or scrapes in the skin. In most areas of the world, rats are the main animal host for fleas injected with murine typhus. Murine typhus occurs in tropical and subtropical climates around the world where rats and their fleas live. Yet now it seems that the disease is taking over and spreading along with hepatitis A through Los Angeles, thanks to the socialist policies that enrich the political elites and enslave and impoverish everyone else. The city is spinning out of control. As people struggle to make ends meet and carry the tax burden of a city, state, and federal government hell-bent on overspending, the area continues to descend into a third world hellscape. Sadly, the return of a disease thought left behind in medieval times, such as typhus, is only the tip of the proverbial iceberg when it comes to problems in Los Angeles. For months, county health officials attempted to say that typhus only really affects the burgeoning homeless population. However, Deputy City Attorney Liz Greenwood, a veteran prosecutor, told NBC4 that she was diagnosed with typhus in November after experiencing high fevers and excruciating headaches. "I felt like somebody was driving railway stakes through my eyes and out the back of my head," Greenwood told the I-team. "Who gets typhus? It's a medieval disease that's caused by trash. Everyone in L.A. can now apparently get typhus thanks to the very left-leaning policies they've allowed. And yes, it's not just the homeless. Now, those who live in filthy conditions, yes, perhaps run a greater risk. But fleas are indiscriminate. They'll land and bite wherever there's an opportunity." Responding to complaints from other city workers fearful of getting typhus, the city fumigated the Los Angeles Police Department Central Division office, as well as parts of the LAPD's main headquarters, according to NBC4. The deputy city attorney reportedly said she will not go back to work at City Hall East until they also fumigate that building too. Yet that's all just treating the symptoms of the problem. The city is spending money they don't have to fumigate buildings they paid for with stolen money. That's taxing the residents. And looking to constantly raise taxes to help get rid of typhus. But that disease will eradicate itself when people aren't forced to share living spaces with rats that carry infected fleas. This is just this is all just a symptom of the major disease, communism, that's swiftly sweeping its way through big cities in the United States. No amount of taxation or theft will fix this. And actually, what might fix it, or at least a way to fix, would be getting control of the third world invasion, particularly the invasion of the illegals across, mostly across, the Mexican border. There's been a rift, it would seem, between some of the intelligence chiefs and Donald Trump, particularly on issues such as Syria, where Donald Trump believes ISIS has been essentially defeated, North Korea, where he believes we have to negotiate, the other thing, the other key area is Russia. Much of the foreign policy establishment is, and the intelligence establishment is pathologically anti-Russia, partly because it's led by a nationalist, and nationalism is out of favor among a lot of these people. This is a recent article, actually a February 1st article by Pat Buchanan. To manifest his opposition, I should probably give you the title of this, Trump versus the Spy Chiefs. To manifest his opposition to President Donald Trump's decision to pull all 2,000 U.S. troops out of Syria and half of the 14,000 from Afghanistan, General James Mattis went public and resigned as Secretary of Defense. Now, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, in public testimony to Congress, has contradicted Trump about the threats that face the nation. Contrary to what the president believes, Coates says, North Korea is unlikely to give up its nuclear weapons. ISIS remains a serious threat, even if the caliphate has been rolled up, and it has. And there's no evidence that Iran, though hostile and aggressive, is acquiring nuclear weapons. CIA Director Gina Haspel agreed. Iran remains in compliance with the nuclear treaty that Trump has trashed and abandoned. The treaty is still doing what it was designed to do. At this perceived public defiance, Trump exploded. Quote, the intelligence people seem to be extremely passive and naive when it comes to the dangers for Iran. They're wrong. The Iranians are testing rockets last week and more and are coming very close to the edge. Be careful of Iran. Trump added, perhaps intelligence should go back to school. Trump then brought up the epical blunder of U.S. intelligence in backing the Bush second claim that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. A slam dunk, Bush said, and was a grave threat to the USA, in point of fact. While Israel had weapons of mass destruction, that's nuclear, chemical, and biological, after scouring Iraq, after the Americans inflicted about 600,000 deaths, mostly civilian. What did they come up with? Absolutely no evidence of any weapons of mass destruction. And Iraq's military equipment was vintage 1960s Soviet, 40 years aged and very, very out of date, and no match for the American technology. There was no threat from Iraq. Of course, Iraq was on the hit list put out by the Israelis, and unfortunately, and the American administrations have been doing Israel's bidding for over half a century. Born of incompetence and mendacity, that council led to the greatest strategic blunder of the 21st century, if not of U.S. history. The Second Iraq War. Launched by George W. Bush, this invasion plunged us into the Middle East forever war and got the Republican Party ejected from power in 2006 and 2008. While it's not unusual for a president and the intelligence community to diverge on the gravity of a threat, what is astonishing is that the intel leaders would declare a president to be flat-out wrong. Yet the confrontation is not unhealthy, for it reflects reality. On foreign policy, We are divided not only on means, but on ends. And the division calls to mind Walter Lippmann's words after U.S. political clashes and unpreparedness in FDR's New Deal decade led to the early disasters at Pearl Harbor, Bataan, and Corregidor. These were big U.S. military defeats in the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, which perhaps was not so much of a surprise, and then the initial battlefield defeats at Bataan and Corregidor. Quote, for nearly 50 years, wrote the Dean of American Columnists, the nation had not had a settled and a generally accepted foreign policy. This is a danger to the Republic, for when a people is divided about the conduct of its foreign relations, it's unable to agree on the determination of its true interests. It's unable to prepare adequately for war or to safeguard successfully its peace. We seem to be in just such a situation today, writes Pat Buchanan. Indeed, Trump is president because of the foreign policy disasters produced by his predecessors, who leaned on the U.S. intel community, and because Trump in 2016 appeared to read the nation right. Yet there is common ground between Trump and the spy chiefs. Coates and Haspel are correct that the U.S. faces a Russia and China that are more closer and more collaborative than they've been since the 1950s, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, which Mao saw as Moscow capitulation. And as we have more in common with Russia, with its historic ties to the West, that Russia appears by far the lesser long-term threat, how do we split Russia off from China? Here, Trump's instincts are right, and the Beltway Russell folks are wrong. As for Iran, the intelligence community is consistent. In 2007 and 2011, the CIA declared with high confidence that Iran had no nuclear weapons program. Now, with UN inspectors crawling all over Tehran's nuclear facilities under the treaty, the CIA and DNI are still saying the same thing. One of the contention that Iran is seeking hegemony in the Middle East. Really? How? When a nuclear-armed Israel, which has launched 200 strikes on Iran's allies in Syria, accept that? Would Turkey? What would Turkey, with the second largest army in NATO, Egypt, the largest Arab nation, and Saudi Arabia have to say about it? How could Shiite Iran, whose Persian majority is nearly matched by its Arab, Azeri, Baloch, and Kurdish minorities, gain dominance over a Mideast where the vast majority is Sunni Arab, they're of course a different branch of Islam from the Iranians. Now is Iran a threat to us, how is Iran a threat to us over there, compared to the threat we pose to Iran? Iran broke out of its isolation for two reasons. First, George W. Bush came in and overthrew its Taliban enemies on its eastern border. And then he overthrew Saddam Hussein, the enemy on its western border. As Trump contends, ISIS has been defeated and driven from its twin capitals of Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq. But it's also true that ISIS and Al-Qaeda still have tens of thousands of jihadists living among the people of the Middle East. And the great question remains, are U.S. troops necessary over there to prevent terrorists from coming over here? Or are they over here because we are over there? And those are good questions. And of course, particularly apropos is the fact if Western Army, particularly the Americans, were not endlessly at the behest of Israel, attacking people in the Middle East, there would be less of a provocation. And while there's no doubt there is a Muslim threat, regardless of Israel, to the West, it is exacerbated by the fact that the West, particularly the West, particularly the United States, is seen to be merely Israel's enforcer in the Middle East, the connection with Israel is actually is absolutely catastrophic for America. I don't agree with Trump that Iran is particularly a danger. Iran is has serious economic problems. Iran is has been isolated, and Iran does not threaten the West. Other countries do. Iran is not trying to export something to the West. Iran, or the Persians, who are Persians and who are also actually Aryans, are interested in regaining the status, the influence they once had in the Middle East, and that's perfectly understandable. Okay. Here's an interesting story. It's official. Virginia's Lieutenant Governor's sexual assault allegations has become another dumpster fire for the Democrats. Yes, of course, there is a huge problem in Virginia right now, it's one that we spoke about on the once a week radio program called the Ethno State earlier today, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. Well, it's official. The sexual assault allegations against Virginia Democratic Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax has become a total dumpster fire for Democrats. The allegations, allegation has zero corroboration, but allegedly Fairfax sexually assaulted the woman during the Democratic National Convention back in 2004. The Washington Post, WUSA 9, and other Virginia news outlets have known about this allegation but didn't run with it because they couldn't verify the story. Fairfax has strongly denied the allegation and said the encounter was consensual. Was there someone, Kavanaugh cough, who faced similar shoddy allegations but was smeared as a sexual predator in an attempt to block his Supreme Court nomination? Yes, there was, which makes this whole story all the more satisfying. The left's own rules have ensnared one of them, and the irony is thick. I don't think seeing people's lives destroyed over baseless allegations, I don't like seeing people's lives destroyed over baseless allegations, but as I said, there aren't many rules. Now they're getting punched in the mouth with them. Regardless of the allegation, who leaked it? Well, Fairfax has a primary suspect, embattled Democratic Governor Ralph Northam, who's facing a political crisis of his own after his yearbook page from his days at Eastern Virginia Medical School back in 1984, featuring a cartoon showing two men, one of them wearing blackface and the other in full Ku Klux Klan regalia. He apologized and admitted he was in the photo, but then retracted the apology and said it wasn't him. But he then did engage in blackface, that's putting on makeup, black makeup, to pretend to be a Negro, while participating in a dance competition when he was in the army in San Antonio, and he was imitating Michael Jackson. As calls for his resignation increased, this Fairfax story dropped. On top of that, we have a mini media war going on. Fairfax said in a statement denying the allegation that the Washington Post found red flags in the accuser's story. Not the case. The publication noted that they just couldn't verify the story because it was grounded in he said, she said. There was no other evidence. This prompted another statement from Fairfax accusing the Post of spreading a smear against him. And they may well be doing it. And now a Fairfax accuser has hired the firm that helped Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who initially came forward with a sexual assault allegation against Supreme Court Justice, but at that time he was the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, which also couldn't be corroborated. In fact, from her skanky past, it was highly unlikely that it happened as Ms. Ford alleged. He said that, well, she couldn't remember how she got home, and she couldn't remember this, and couldn't remember that, but was pretty sure that Brett Kavanaugh was in the room when she was, she wasn't raped, but she was perhaps manhandled a bit. And she had a real reputation in high school. She was only 15 at the time. California woman has accused Virginia Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax of sexually assaulting her 15 years ago, and she's hired the same law firm that represented Christine Blasey Ford in her allegations against then Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Fairfax has denied the allegations, which first surfaced on a conservative blog and later described in a report by the Washington Post. The allegation has come to light just as Fairfax could be on the verge of becoming the state's chief executive in the wake of a scandal involving Democrat Governor Ralph Northam and a black-faced yearbook photo. The woman making the accusation against Fairfax has retained Katz, Marshall, and Banks, a Washington, D.C.-based firm, and is consulting with her attorneys about the next steps, according to a source close to the legal team. The law firm assisted Blasey Ford as she came forward during Kavanaugh's confirmation process with allegations that he assaulted her when the two were in high school. The Virginia Black Legislative Caucus has called on Northam to resign, as most of the Democratic Party candidates for president. But now say they will have to reassess their position on Mr. Fairfax, who would take over for Northam should he resign. The report goes on. The Virginia Legislative Black Caucus issued a statement saying it takes all allegations of sexual assault or misconduct with utmost seriousness. Given the recent allegations against Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus will continue to assess this developing situation as more details become available. The Virginia GOP looked like they were on life support, but this collapse by Virginia Democrats could possibly yield some dividends in the upcoming legislative elections. It's an off year, and the top of the ticket is now marred in controversy. The anti-racist candidate turned out to engage in allegedly racist antics regarding blackface. This is not me, this is the commentator. I can see Democrats being depressed, but the obvious caveat is that the next election is months away. A lot can happen. Still, with Northam digging in, he's gumming up the works for his party, while allegedly knifing those who think they could take his spot. In one weekend, the Virginia Democratic Party ate itself, and unless Northam caves, I suspect this circus will continue a while longer. And this is one of the delightful things about this whole Governor Northam issue. It's a case where the revolution is eating its own. And this has happened before. Radical ideological fanatics. This happened during the French Revolution. Many of the initial revolutionaries were themselves guillotined or executed. This happened in the Russian Revolution. Longtime comrades would, even into the 30s, be purged by Stalin. People who'd spent their adult lifetime toiling for the workers' paradise in the Communist Party would, under duress, plead guilty to the most extreme things that they were. In fact, CIA, well, that was before the CIA. They were capitalist agents. They were this and they were that. It truly is is delightful to see this happening. Specifically, it's one of these cases where you don't know whom to cheer for. So, Governor Northam was revealed to have had pictures taken, allegedly, of himself, either in blackface or in a Ku Klux Klan robe. And that was for his yearbook when he was in Eastern Virginia Medical School back in 1984. At first, he admitted it. Well, then that was on Friday. Then on Saturday, he retracted and said he wasn't either of those men. But he had already admitted that on another occasion, when he was in the Army in San Antonio, he had dressed up in blackface for Michael Jackson's sort of dance contest. And at that news conference, so out of it is this guy, he actually started to do some moonwalking, which was something Michael Jackson did in his early days, and Northam's wife had to restrain him. Now, Northam is not a white nationalist. He's not a conservative. He is a left-wing Democrat. In fact, you would say would be the anti-racist, anti-white candidate. Well, of course, it's deliciously ironic that Mr. Anti-Racist, 35 years ago, did things that would today be denounced as racist, or at least not sufficiently respectful of minorities, or favored minorities. it says a lot about the shallowness of some people. Was Governor Northam ever a proud, conscious white? Well, we don't know, and he certainly hasn't said, but he certainly doesn't appear to be that today. So part of me, of course, likes the idea of him being brought low for at the very least, hypocrisy. On the other hand, though, this is part of the madness. And to hear the talking heads, many of them black but not all, on Friday night on CNN was to descend into the world of madness. You would almost think that this was the French mob at the guillotine that you'd see in the movie of representation, or the movie adaptation of Charles Dickens' Great Tale of Two Cities. The mob howling for the guillotine to swoop down the trundle and cut the poor devil's head off. And people, women particularly, near the edge of the platform on which this would happen, knitting or gleefully waiting for the head to tumble and roll, and perhaps they could even collect the head in a wicker basket. These were fanatical times, where one day a man was a proud citoyen, a proud revolutionary, and the next day he could be denounced as a monarchist or anything and lose his head. There was no proportion, and that's the problem with revolutions and revolutionaries. And in the end, the chaos was such the French people were begging for somebody to restore order, and that happened with Napoleon. But that's another story. So, while part of me enjoys the comeuppance of a hypocrite, or at the very least, a shallow man, part of me also says, there's madness here. Why would those, that even if he were either the man in blackface or the man in the Ku Klux Klan world, how is that racist? Does that say I hate anybody or I want to put anybody down? No, for one thing, it's costuming, it's clowning. He's a university student. It's wearing costumes. But we have developed exceedingly sensitive feelings, as because as elements of our nations have become a collection of snowflakes, is dressing up as a character disrespectful of anybody? No. Young boys have for decades dressed up as pirates, you know, with a do-rag on their head and a patch over their eye and a sword and maybe even a if they can get a costume story, a hook for their hand, you know. Does that mean they want to be lawless pirates? They want to grow up to rob innocent people and perhaps murder them? No, it's just a game. It's just an act. Similarly, blackface, actually, as we discussed on the Ethnostate today, blackface goes back to the minstrel shows in the late 19th and early 20th century. Almost all the performers singing songs that about Negroes or imitating Negroes were performed by white people, including the Jewish singer Al Jolson in the first talkie movie, The Jazz Singer. Now, these the minstrel shows were not meant to mock black people. They were meant to use some of their music and reflect back on the days of the blacks on plantations and so on. Now, it may have been an idealized view, but it was not it was not meant to be insulting. So I would argue that wearing blackface, depending on the context, isn't even racist in the sense of wanting to put somebody else down because of race. The Ku Klux Klan garb is really just a uniform of a group. And I don't see that as racist either, any more than it would be to dress up as a as a policeman or a Viking or a pirate. That's costuming. Presumably these pictures were taken as part of some sort of university pranks. But unfortunately, the offense is not made. Some opportunistic spokesman for the Republican Party was saying, you know, such racism could not be tolerated in Virginia. Well, I'm not sure it is racism. The governor's record is one of being very much pro-black. If there's any racism, it's the fact that he is certainly not being pro-white. Then there is the utter intolerance. Something that was done 35 years ago when he was still a university student is to ruin his career. Something that was legal. It might have been bad judgment, but how many young college students have not done something that was showed bad judgment? Well, most have. This was not a crime. He didn't rape somebody. He didn't murder somebody. He didn't rob a bank. At worst, it could be said, he showed he was immature. And yet, the opportunistic Republicans many Democrats, including Hillary Clinton, the two Virginia Democratic senators, many members of the House of Representatives, all have called upon him to resign. Well, what would resigning do? The ending of his political career, and I'm not in favor of it, incidentally. You know, this is not a matter of, I think the guy should be saved because he's valuable. But I don't like to see the way, the witch hunt, the way this is done. Now, what would happen, I think, is that to the extent this matters to the Negro voters in Virginia, he might be somewhat weakened at the polls. Well, that's a price you pay. One of the few sensible voices was former Democratic, former Virginia Democratic member of the House of Representatives, Jim Moran. Even if the worst case scenario is true, I think there's an issue of redemption. Ralph understands the endemic racism that's been part of Virginia society for so long. Well, as long as you've got weak whites repudiating their history, the minorities just feel their Cheerios all the more. This is the time when whites have to become more conscious as whites and stop apologizing. See, well, once you buy into the fact that the entire American history is racist, then you are buying into an ideological justification for exactly what's going on with immigration replacement. And that's what worries me more about this issue than whether this Democrat will be able to save his hide or not. Well, this is Paul Froman. You're on the Fighting Side of Me here on White Resistance Radio. Gonna take a musical break now. Here are two of the greatest country and western singers of their generation: Merle Haggard, who fortunately is now dead, and the very beautiful Connie Smith, who is still very much with us. And this is a duet they did together, A Place to Fall Apart. That's Merle Haggard and Connie Smith.
There's a lady that I've known for many, many years who's been standing back here helping us with the background. She did Leona Williams' part on The Roots of My Raisin. She did the part on... what else do we've done so many songs tonight? The Way I Am, I think it was. Isn't that what? Would you make welcome someone who is one of the greatest singers I've ever met, Miss Connie Smith? Would you make welcome? Good evening, Connie.
Are you all right?
You got on my cord. Don't get on my cord.
I'm sorry, Merle. How could I do that?
I knew people that used to copy this lady right down to her laugh. Her laugh was even unique. We're going to try to do a song that me and Janie Fricke had a number one record on. It's called A Place to Fall Apart. Freddie Powers and I and Willie Nelson. I don't know how Willie got his name on this song. Now I remember. Let me tell you about it. Freddie came up to me and he said, how come you haven't written anything about your divorce? And I said, I don't want to write anything about it. And I said, if I was going to write anything, I'd write a letter. He said, well, write it. And we were in that same room where we rehearsed this song, in the very same room all those years ago. And he said, why don't you write the letter? And I said, I don't want to write her no letter. He said, well, write one. And he said, we won't mail it.
That's the best thing to do with the letter.
Well, that's the best thing to do with these kind of letters. And about 3 or 4 weeks before that, Freddie had came out from Texas and out to California and said, you know, Willie's really got a great title for a song. It's called A Place to Fall Apart. And I said, that is a good title. I'll probably never see you eye to eye again. This letter's meant to be my last farewell. But you need to understand I'm nearly crazy. You need to know my life's gone to hell.
Oh, write me back and tell me why it ended. I need some final proof to show my heart. I'll be somewhere between I love you and what you're feeling now. looking for a place to fall apart.
Looking for a place to fall apart. Trying to find a place I can leave my heart. I need to be somewhere hiding when I feel the teardrops start. Looking for a place to call home.
I can't seem to justify your leaving me, and I'm bewildered as to how it all came down.
I thought everything was fine till your phone call. The call to turn my world around.
Send me word and tell me why it ended. Oh, I need some final proof to show my heart.
I'll be somewhere between I love you and what you're feeling now. Looking for a place to fall apart. Looking for a place to fall apart. Trying to find a place I can leave my heart. I need to be somewhere hide when I feel the teardrops start. Looking for a place to fall apart. Looking for a place to fall apart. Trying to find a place I can leave my heart. I need to be somewhere hiding when I feel the teardrops start. Looking for a place to fall apart.
Miss Connie Smith.
That's a great one by Merle Haggard and Connie Smith. Place to Fall Apart. A little bit of historical background. Here's another blonde, lovely country western singer. When the Grass Grows Over Me, Rhonda Vincent. I always love Rhonda singing. And this is Rhonda Vincent, When the Grass Grows Over Me. I'm a place where we have a relatively slow internet connection, so we have a little bit of a gap here. This is When the Grass Grows Over Me, which I...
expect to hear me say that I grows over me.
Song. This is I'm Not Over You. Oh, wait, so we just had that. Here's a song with a person who sometimes sings with her, Carl Jackson, and his group, The Little Mountain Church. Some bluegrass gospel, The Little Mountain Church with Carl Jackson. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on The Fighting Side of Me here on LightResistanceRadio.com. I say the connection is a little slow here, so we do have a little bit of a gap or hiatus, but this is Carl Jackson.
There's a little mountain church in my thoughts of yesterday. Where friends and family gathered for the Lord. There an old-fashioned preacher off the straight and narrow way, for what few coins a congregation could afford. Dressed in all our Sunday best, we sat on pews of solid oak, and I remember how our voices filled the air. How Mama sounded like an angel on those high soprano notes of when the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. All day Sunday singings and dinner on the ground, Many were the souls that were revived. While the brothers and the sisters who'd gone on to glory land slept in peace in the maple grove nearby. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon. Looking back now, that little mountain church house has become my life's cornerstone. It was there in that little mountain church house I first heard the word I based my life upon.
From, and you're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.